This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. I appreciate you tuning in to Trumpet Hour. This is Joel Hilliker. We're gearing up for Thanksgiving Day tomorrow here in the United States. Looking forward to that. We're hosting a group of, I think, about 25 friends and family at our house. Really looking forward to a very nice afternoon tomorrow. We had our Thanksgiving ball at Armstrong College this past Sunday night. I was talking with a couple of people about Thanksgiving, about just how important it is that we be thankful people. Gratitude is a wonderful virtue to have, to be a grateful person, to be able to focus on your blessings and recognize where those blessings came from. I was reminded of an essay that I read some years ago by Marcus Aurelius. He was one of the Roman emperors, and he, in a very detailed way, he went down this kind of inventory of all of his blessings and everything that he had acquired in terms of skills and knowledge in his life. And he gave credit for every one of those things to who it was in his life who had helped him to gain that. Who was he indebted to for these gifts in his life? And it just struck me as such a humble, magnanimous way of thinking. I think it would take a lot of effort to just think through everything that you have in your life and then to think where that came from and who you should really be thankful for about that. At the end of today's program, for the last word today, I'm going to talk a bit about prayer and the most powerful result that prayer can accomplish. But if you look at what the Bible says about prayer, thanksgiving is a crucial part of what God wants us to be praying about. Philippians 4:6 says, "In everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God." So if you're doing that, if you're praying every day, and you're really including thanksgiving in everything that you pray, you're building a thankful state of mind every day. And that's a wonderful thing to do. It strikes me that the world today teaches virtually the opposite of that kind of thinking. People are taught to despise things they should be grateful for. They're taught to feel entitled, to think that the world owes them a certain kind of treatment or a certain standard of living, regardless of whether they work for it or not. And it really focuses people's attention on the ways that the world is unfair or unequal. It's a very ungrateful, unthankful way of thinking, and it makes people miserable. I wanted to read just a couple of quotes from a book by Dennis Prager called Happiness is a Serious Problem, a Human Nature Repair Manual. So he's talking about the causes for happiness, and he says, yes, there is a secret to happiness, and it is gratitude. All happy people are grateful, and ungrateful people cannot be happy. We tend to think that it is being unhappy that leads people to complain, but it is truer to say that it is complaining that leads to people becoming unhappy. Become grateful, and you will become a much happier person. I think that is a very profound thought that's worth considering and applying in our lives every day. And this is another quote from this book. This is a little more specific, but it applies to so much of what you see taking place in the world today. Dennis Prager writes, "There are some clear rules about happiness. One is that you cannot be happy if your primary identity is that of a victim, even if you really are one. There are a number of reasons. People who regard themselves as victims do not see themselves as in control of their lives. Whatever happens in their lives happens to them, not by them. People who primarily regard themselves as victims see the world as unfair to them in particular. Just as the young student who always sees himself as being picked on is an unhappy soul, so is the person who carries that attitude into adulthood. People who regard themselves primarily as victims are angry people, and an angry disposition renders happiness impossible. People who have chosen to regard themselves as victims cannot allow themselves to enjoy life, because enjoying life would challenge their perception of themselves as victims." Well, that's a little bit less about gratitude than it is about just happiness in general, but It does strike me that there's a very strong polar opposite between gratitude and that victim mentality that Mr. Prager was talking about. But just a couple of thoughts I wanted to share with you as you go into Thanksgiving. It's a wonderful holiday. Even if you're not an American, you don't celebrate on that day. It's a good idea to take time to be thankful every day, to be a thankful person. Well, we here at The Trumpet, we just finished the January 2020 issue of the magazine. That's going up online today at thetrumpet.com. And the cover story is by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. The title is K.T. Zu Gutenberg About to Come to Power? There's a fantastic illustration of Carl Theodor Zu Gutenberg on the cover by our on-staff artist, Gary Dorning. He's been experimenting with a new illustration style for quite some time. There was some months ago he started working on this portrait of Mr. Gutenberg, and as I was putting this issue together, we had this major article by Gerald Fleury about this man, and right out of the blue, Gary sent me an email with a picture of the latest version, how that illustration was coming, and I just said, well, that is too perfect to be coincidental. It just worked out perfectly, and that is the cover for this next issue. But Mr. Fleury talks in that article about the political leadership crisis in Germany right now. Chancellor Angela Merkel is on her way out. She's physically pretty compromised, politically weakened right now. So there's a lot of talk about who will succeed her. And later in today's program, we're going to have a conversation with trumpet writer Josue Michels about what's happening over there. And he has a pretty interesting prediction, or at least something to watch for the weekend of December 6th through 8th that he'll tell us about. But we're going to start the program today by talking about what some people are calling the greatest threat facing humanity today. Somewhere in the world, environmental disasters are always wreaking destruction and taking lives. This year, we've seen Hurricane Dorian.
All right, we got to move. We have to jump the fence. Okay, we got to jump.
Cyclone Idai. The Midwest U.S. bomb cyclone. We saw earthquakes in Indonesia. We saw tornadoes in the United States. Recent weeks have seen deadly disasters, including wildfires in California, floods in Italy, devastating droughts in Australia and South Africa. These disasters are drastically different, even opposite one another, with extreme dryness and extreme flooding. They're hitting disparate locations across the globe, and yet they're believed to all trace back to a common cause. The 2019 California wildfire season included more than 6,000 fires. They burned an estimated 200,000 acres. They killed three people, damaged or destroyed more than 700 structures. And some of these scorched areas were still recovering from wildfires in 2017 and 2018 that destroyed more than 32,000 buildings and killed 150 people. Energy companies cut electricity to 2.7 million Californians to prevent their lines and their equipment from igniting new fires in these dry, windy conditions. There were thousands of evacuees who struggled to find shelter. Well, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted this. "This is what climate change looks like." And she linked to footage of these California fires. She tweeted, "The GOP like to mock scientific warnings about climate change as exaggeration. But just look around. It's already starting. We have 10 years to cut carbon emissions in half. If we don't, scenes like this can get much worse." That was California, nearly 11,000 miles away. South Africa's water taps are running dry. Low rainfall, poor infrastructure have left thousands of people without water in the Eastern Cape province. Five villages have been without running water since July. There are livestock that lie dead, crops are withered, schools are closed. One hydrology expert says that South Africa is suffering its worst drought in 1,000 years. And this is what Forbes reported. Southern Africa is feeling the effects of climate change. The United Nations is reporting that prolonged droughts there and across the continent have led to food shortages, which will impact 45 million people In southern Africa, temperatures are rising at twice the global average. A University of Cape Town climate scientist, Peter Johnston, he wrote on a website called theconversation.com that researchers foresee further increases in temperature caused by carbon emissions. So that is South Africa. Then about 8,800 miles north of that, the people in Venice, Italy, they would have gladly given South Africans water if they could. The streets there became raging rivers, century-old buildings flooded as waters rose to their highest point since 1966. The rising water levels are making floods in Venice more common, and they're threatening what is really a haven for tourists. Mayor Luigi Brugnaro said this on Twitter: "This is the result of climate change." Southeast of Venice, 16,300 miles southeast in Australia, the average rainfall for the first 9 months of 2019 was at its lowest since 1965, and the average temperatures were the highest since record keeping started in 1910. So there's a severe water shortage down there that's devastating farmland across Queensland and New South Wales, and it's causing what some sources say is the worst drought in more than 400 years. In the Murray-Darling Basin, which is Australia's main agricultural region, one of the largest dams is barely 4% full. Water supply is about to run dry in many towns, and summer is coming down there in the southern hemisphere. Some farmers are asking for aid to abandon their farms. Now, Australia was once the world's top wool producer. It was its fourth largest wheat exporter. But right now, its sheep flock is at a 100-year low, and it had to import wheat this year. Many of Australia's prime breeding cows are being slaughtered because they just don't have enough water and enough feed. So farmers are trying to get whatever they can from these animals because they just can't support them anymore. Now, these dry conditions have combined with high winds to create huge brush fires along the east coast of Australia. 4,000 square miles have been burned across New South Wales. That's three times more than last season. And this is before summer even began. The smoke from these fires reached New Zealand, which is 2,500 miles away. The Guardian reported this: temperature, fuel load, dryness, wind speed, and humidity all affect fire risk and are compounded by global heating. The link between rising greenhouse gas emissions and increased bushfire risk is complex, but according to major science agencies, it is clear. Climate change does not create bushfires, but it can and does make them worse. So many different emergencies, but according to these sources that I've been quoting, there's one single cause behind all of them. Whenever any kind of disaster like this strikes, this is what the politicians and the pundits and the media personalities point to. Even threats that seem wholly unrelated are also being traced back to this same cause. After a hunter in Inner Mongolia recently ate a wild rabbit, China suffered an outbreak of bubonic plague, and state media said that rodent populations in this area mushroomed because of droughts, and the droughts intensified because of climate change. The list of global problems being blamed on climate change is growing rapidly. And this list includes, but it's not limited to, more floods, more droughts, more wildfires, more heat waves, rising temperatures, dropping temperatures, increased tornadoes, stronger hurricanes, rising sea levels, shrinking Arctic sea ice, higher ocean acidity, less drinking water, imperiled agriculture, expanding desertification, multiplying disease-carrying insects. And then climate change is blamed for the problems that result from those types of things. The deprivation, the malnutrition, starvation, economic inequality, civil unrest, population displacement, and many, many more problems. As the list of climate change consequences grows, more and more people are rallying to the common cause of combating this problem.
We are all all here because we are fighting for our futures and the futures of the next generation and our planet. So thank you all for being here.
The most impressive demonstration came on September 20th when millions of people across an estimated 185 countries linked up in marches to protest this problem. It was a dramatic climax of a growing outcry against what more and more people consider the greatest threat facing humanity. Now, in order to get that many people on board with something, in order to get scientists and educators and politicians and celebrities and pundits and professionals and students and even children, millions of people from nearly every country on earth to agree on something, well, it has to be something very simple. And what we're talking about here is exceedingly simple. It is the idea that an entire panoply of catastrophe and chaos all fits neatly into a single basket called climate change. And it goes beyond that. They also say this is a problem with a clearly identifiable cause, carbon emissions. So in order to solve all these troubles, all that humanity has to do is one thing: generate less carbon. It's a very simple message, and anyone who disagrees with it is viewed as ignorant, possibly evil, maybe a threat to humanity. And every time another disaster strikes, it's held up as more proof that world leaders are not doing enough to force carbon reduction. And so disasters keep happening, and the activists get more and more impatient. Their warnings are getting more extreme. Their solutions, their proposals are getting more radical. And their voices are becoming more shrill.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
That was 16-year-old activist Greta Thunberg speaking to the United Nations in the days after those mass protests in September. This idea that she is expounding on has grown stunningly popular. The idea that climatic shifts will bring mass extinction and the only prevention is to reshape modern civilization. More specifically, saving the world from environmental annihilation requires that the West abandon free market economics. There was a blunt headline by The Guardian that captured the gist of this argument. It said, "Ending climate change requires the end of capitalism. Have we got the stomach for it?" On November 5th, 2019, the academic journal Bioscience published a declaration signed by 11,000 scientists that said this, quote, "Clearly and unequivocally, planet Earth is facing a climate emergency, and an immense increase of scale in endeavors to conserve our biosphere is needed to avoid untold suffering due to the climate crisis." So what sort of endeavors are they proposing here? Their recommendations include ending fossil fuel drilling, reducing living standards for rich people, shrinking national economies, taking meat off the menu. There are a whole lot of proposals here, but the crux of these proposals really get down to population control. This declaration by these scientists says, "The world population must be stabilized and ideally gradually reduced." And it says that there are, quote, "proven and effective policies that strengthen human rights while lowering fertility rates." So these policies that they're talking about include government-supplied contraception and abortion. They're literally talking about killing more babies in the womb as a means of reducing population pressure on the Earth to reduce carbon emissions. That's what these scientists are proposing. Now, a report endorsed by 11,000 scientists, that sounds unimpeachable. That sounds like virtual scientific unanimity. And what sort of barbarian would disagree with 11,000 scientists? But there were several skeptics that scoured the list of these quote-unquote scientists. And they found that there were a whole lot of names on this list, huge numbers of these supposed scientists that had questionable credentials. The list included a lot of students, a lot of researchers, a lot of professors or associate professors in fields that have nothing to do with climate, fields like gynecology or ethnomusicology or food safety. Some of the people on this list had no credentials at all. One of the signatories was actually Mickey Mouse, professor at the Mickey Mouse Institute for the Blind. This is one of the names that was on the list of these 11,000 scientists. And you know, there's a good reason that these skeptics were suspicious when they heard about this declaration, why they went digging to see, well, who are these 11,000 scientists? The reason why they were thinking that way is because this kind of fraud is routine in climate change science. Just to give you one example, the U.S. government's fourth national climate assessment in November 2018, just a year ago, this included a series of charts showing trend lines that presumably prove climate change. And they distribute this, the National Climate Assessment, they distribute this to politicians and journalists who are responsible for reporting on climate change and making policy because of their recommendations. Now, what's interesting about this set of charts in this National Climate Assessment is that the start date for each of the trends is different. There's a graph there talking about how heat waves have been increasing since 1960. There's another graph showing Arctic sea ice declining since 1979. There's a chart that shows U.S. wildfires increasing since 1983. Another chart shows sea levels rising since 1920. So why the differences in the start dates for these different trends? If climate change is constant, if this has been happening since the Industrial Revolution or since the increase in carbon emissions in modern times, well, then you could practically select your dates arbitrarily and you would always get the same result. If this is a broad-based trend that's going to wipe out humanity, you could pick your dates anytime and that's the result you would get. But that isn't even close to being the case. In this case, the parameters for each of these charts were deliberately chosen to make sure that the trend line told the right story. Scientist Tony Heller did a video exposing this fraud, and he said, when you want to mislead people with statistics, picking your start date is very important. So the National Climate Assessment chose the dates for each of these charts that would not show the hotter temperatures prior to 1960. They chose not to show the decreased sea ice prior to 1979. They chose not to show the far larger number of acres burned by wildfires before 1983. They didn't want you to see that. If you back the start date up for each of these charts, you see a very different trend line. Wildly different trend line. And meanwhile, statistics show that sea levels have actually been rising at a steady, slow rate of 2.84 millimeters per year since at least the mid-1800s, and they were also rising for thousands of years before that. So to say that, well, it's been rising since 1920, it doesn't tell the whole story. In fact, it tells a very misleading story. And this was such a blatant, outrageous manipulation of data by people who know what they are doing. They are deliberately deceiving people to believe their climate change narrative. And this really proves that. If climate change were everything that it is purported to be, you would never need to resort to this kind of deception. Certainly are scientists, actual scientists with actual expertise in climatology, who believe that human activity is creating apocalyptic conditions. These scientists do exist. But before we start dismantling civilization, before we start purging the planet of people in order to reduce our carbon emissions, it's worth remembering the fact that science's track record on these types of questions is abysmal. The notion that the only hope for this doomed planet is to eliminate human beings, this has been around for decades. 50 years ago, Stanford professor Paul Ehrlich suggested that to prevent global cooling the government might reduce the population by putting sterility drugs in the food and water supply. In 1971, John P. Holdren, this man later became President Barack Obama's science advisor, he wrote an essay titled Overpopulation and the Potential for Ecocide, and it warned of a coming ice age, an ice age caused by overpopulation. And these examples of this kind of deranged thinking, these kinds of failed predictions, there are so many of them. Science has predicted and struck out so many times. And we need to be reminded of facts like these because they're being absolutely buried by the noise of climate change alarmism. That alarmism has gotten so clamorous, so loud, that it is drowning out truth. And we're being told that teenagers like Greta Thunberg get it. She gets it. The children get it. The children understand, we're being told, as they scold and scream at the world for all of the supposed inaction regarding climate change. The media are on board this train. More and more leaders are clambering onto the train, or they're being pushed onto it. And they're making ruinous decisions as a result of that. It's become what is considered, presumably, the consensus. But that still doesn't make it true. Every time there's a new disaster, out come the climatologists and representatives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And they talk like all of these curses would go away if only we would all become vegetarians, if only we would build windmills and we would stop flying airplanes. This is delusional, but it's worse than delusional. It's a very dangerous way of thinking, and it's leading to what truly is a terrible, terrible consequence of climate change. It's a consequence with life and death effects. There are a lot of people who look at what's happening and they see dishonesty. They see the hypocrisy of this climate alarmism. There are a lot of people pointing to those things, but even they don't see the real disaster that is taking place here. And that disaster is this. It's the fact that this error that is being promulgated so aggressively obscures the real lesson that we must be taking from these disasters that are unfolding. The focus on climate change hides the real issue. If human carbon emissions aren't causing floods in Venice and droughts in Australia and all of these other disasters, then what is causing that? Now, it's indisputable that human activity does directly cause some nature-related problems. When you burn fossil fuels, it does release pollutants into the air like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide. Now, the U.S. has cut sulfur dioxide emissions by 91%, and it's cut nitrogen oxide emissions by 60% since 1970. But those pollutants do create acid rain that, even though it's a lot better than it was in the 1970s, it still poisons streams and lakes and marshes. Soil degradation, that's another man-made environmental threat. Scientists estimate that our soil has lost 25 to 75% of its organic content since the dawn of human agriculture. And that's mostly caused by crop monocultures, which sap the nutrients out of the soil. But there's also the issue of people building homes in flood zones and coastlines and other high-risk areas. So what would just be normally the routine workings of nature suddenly becomes calamitous because human beings are there. So all of these things are real, and they do increase the damage that is done by these disasters. But there is yet another far more relevant factor to consider regarding the cause of these disasters, and it is a spiritual factor. The creator of the earth has power over the weather. There are many scriptures in the Bible that talk about this fact, and the fact that God uses the weather to accomplish very specific purposes. Notice these promises that God makes in Leviticus 26, verses 3 and 4. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, Then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. I'll contrast that with verses 14 and 19 and 20, which say, but if you will not hearken unto me, and will not do all these commandments, I will make your heaven as iron, and your earth as brass, and your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits. There are a lot of verses like that in the Bible that make very plain that obedience to God leads to rain in its season, and it causes the land to produce plenty. God can create favorable weather and other conditions for people who are faithful to him, but there are times when he holds back rain and he creates other environmental related challenges and problems to correct people who disobey him. This is what Job 37 verses 11 to 13 say. He loads the thick cloud with moisture. The clouds scatter his lightning. They turn round and round by his guidance to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world, whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen. So God does bathe the earth with gentle, life-giving rain to show his loving concern and mercy. But as human beings reject him, and as they hurt his creation and hurt each other, then he sends storms and tornadoes and hurricanes, floods, droughts, other disasters for correction. He's trying to help people recognize that they are pursuing the cursed way, the way of disobedience, the way of immorality and deceit, coveting, violence, hatred, lust, greed, idolatry, blasphemy, vanity, selfishness. Notice what this great creator promises in 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 14. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. That's the plain truth of the Bible. And the people who are attributing these disasters to the supposed sins of emitting carbon or eating meat or having children, rather than the actual sins that God defines in his word, the people who want to say that it's carbon that's creating all of these problems, they are directly contradicting and defying God's truth. When you understand that natural disasters represent our Creator reaching out to us to try to correct us and to guide us back into a relationship with Him, that's when you can really recognize the real tragedy of this climate change delusion. Rather than seeing God, rather than accepting God's correction, people are being moved to anger. They're being stirred to protest and revolt and castigate their leaders. They're throwing their emotional support behind misguided leftist causes. And they're being overtaken by passionate, self-righteous indignation that is weakening society, that's fraying society. This whole trend is covered with the fingerprints of the father of liars who hates human beings. He was a murderer from the beginning, it says in John. Ephesians 2:2 calls him the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. Satan the devil. Revelation 12 and verse 9 says he's an evil dragon who has deceived the whole world. And you know, few issues demonstrate that heartbreaking reality as plainly as this issue of climate change. Now, this is obviously a view that most people would dismiss, most people would mock, but it's very, very plain in the Bible. And if you think about those verses, you think about what's happening here, then this whole nonsensical and bizarre trend of people and nations going after this, it begins to make sense. And even more, you begin to see how these crises, like the droughts in South Africa and Australia, the fires in California, the flooding in Europe, you see how these can actually be solved. I urge you to read our free booklet, Why Natural Disasters, and especially Chapter 3 of this booklet, The Deadly Climate Change Deception. You can find it at thetrumpet.com under our Literature tab. Amid all of the cacophony and the hullabaloo about this subject, what you'll read in that chapter is truth. Absolute truth based on the Bible. It gives the real solution to this problem. And the solution is not suppressing fertility. It's not financing abortions. The solution is to get ourselves right with the Creator God who yearns to bless us.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Who will Germany's next chancellor be? This is the subject of Gerald Fleury's cover story in the January 2020 Trumpet Magazine. We have finished that. It is up on the website at thetrumpet.com today. And a very important article that I would encourage you to read. Germany is in quite a lot of political turmoil right now. And to talk about this, we have trumpet writer and German native, Josue Michels. Hello, Josue. How are you?
Well, thanks for having me, Mr. Hedico.
So let's talk about Chancellor Angela Merkel, first of all. We've actually been talking for years about how her days are numbered. How do we know for sure that it's real this time?
Yes, as you mentioned, it's a gradual decline of her popularity in Germany. And she has faced many challenges, and she has overcome many challenges. But everyone knows her time is nearing, because last year, December 2018, on December 7th, actually, she resigned from her party leadership. And that was an indication for everyone that she is about to resign also from chancellorship very soon. She even said that she wouldn't run for Germany in the next election. So that's a clear sign that her days are numbered, so to say, but we also expect that the coalition which she currently has could break sooner than the next scheduled election in 2021. And if that happens, almost everyone says she would resign.
Okay, so we actually, there was quite a long period there where she struggled to even put a coalition together, and it's been kind of weak from the very beginning, since the last election. Maybe you could just catch us up to speed on the division between these major parties that are in the government.
Yes, that's right. Following the 2017 election, Chancellor Merkel actually tried to put a different coalition together, but after that failed, she negotiated again with her former coalition partner, the Social Democrats. Now, that coalition was very unpopular, and that's why she tried to form another coalition. But because she failed that, she was forced to form a coalition with the Social Democrats. And that took months to form that coalition. And once it was finally formed, state elections came along, and the people voted against those governing parties, and the popularity of those parties further declined. That's why Chancellor Merkel chose to resign from party leadership. And that's why that the division between those parties is growing. They say they work pretty much well together, but the people don't agree, and therefore the division between the party is also growing.
So when would we get some kind of a resolution to this? You mentioned that this could fall apart sooner than the next election. When would that be?
Yes, so people have always speculated that the coalition could break any time. But if it breaks, the most likely date would be December 6th to December 8th. Now, why is that? Basically, the SPD, the Social Democrats that are governing together with Chancellor Merkel, have a big leadership crisis. And they're actually in the process in the moment to select some new leaders to lead them into the next few years. Depending on who those leaders are, it will determine if they continue the coalition or not. Now, on December 6th to December 8th, they're holding a party congress, and then they will decide who the new leaders will be, and those new leaders will then decide if they continue the coalition or not. Now, most think they probably will continue the coalition, but if the coalition breaks, that would be the most likely date for that.
So December 6th through December 8th, that's Well, December 7th is when the Philadelphia Church of God celebrates its 30th anniversary, and we have seen some pretty interesting things happen on that date from time to time. So it could conceivably be even that very date. I guess we'll find out. It was December 7th that a year ago that Merkel actually transferred the leadership of her party over to her successor.
That's right.
Who will replace Angela Merkel? I guess the question, there are probably a number of people who are in the running. And before we start talking about what Mr. Fleury wrote in the Next Trumpet, maybe you could just give us the landscape of candidates.
Yes, so I have watched the trend for years, and there are always different candidates, but none of them really stands out. I just have a survey here from the Wahlkreisprognose.de, and they just looked among the people who they would choose as the next chancellor if they could. And in that survey, they said Armin Laschet, which is the state premier of Westphalia, North Rhine-Westphalia, has a chance of 26%. And they also mentioned Friedrich Merz, the main rival of Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, who has a chance of 24%.
And Karrenbauer is the one that is actually succeeded Merkel for her party leadership.
Yes. So she would most likely to be the chancellor candidate if everything goes well. But the thing is that she has been losing many state elections, or her party has lost many state elections under her leadership. And that's why people think she probably has a less likely chance. And that survey says she has a chance of 13% behind four other candidates, including Markus Söder, which leads Bavaria, and Jens Spahn, who is the health minister. So she's only the fifth most likely candidate, according to what the people think in the moment.
So the next chancellor would be, maybe you could just help us to understand the way that this works politically. People don't vote directly for the chancellor. Is it kind of like a prime minister type of a situation?
Yes. So they are voting for a party, and the party usually has one candidate they send into the elections, which doesn't mean that that candidate becomes chancellor, but if the party gets the most votes, he has the most likely chance to become chancellor.
So they do vote directly for the chancellor. It's just that the party is the one that decides who they're going to put up for election?
They vote for the party, but they know who the party's chancellor candidate is.
I see. So the way that it's shaping up, there really is no one who has come forward as a very strong successor to Angela Merkel, which is quite extraordinary considering how long her leadership has been in this kind of doubtful position, that she's nearing the sunset of her political career. And you would expect that there would be people who would have the ambition to succeed her. But what you're saying is that we really haven't seen a strong candidate emerge.
Yes, and part of that reason is that Chancellor Merkel made sure that all her rivals are being suppressed, so that continued her length in governing. But then she hoped that she could transition the leadership and give it over to her favorite candidate, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, which is a name that's hard to say. But
that's good to hear. That it's hard for you to say.
But she doesn't have the popularity of the people, so Chancellor Merkel's plan, essentially failed in that.
So let's talk about this this article from Gerald Fleury, because he's obviously looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy. And we've talked he's really highlighted these prophecies for many years. And Bible prophecy has a lot to say about the leader of Germany at a critical period in German history, or German prophecy, and what's going to be happening in that country as events are unfolding in the very end time. You want to just talk about that for a bit?
Yes. Because of those prophecies, we expected that there would be quite some turmoil in the German leadership at the top of the German government. So we weren't sure what exactly would happen to necessitate a strong man to rise, but we were fairly sure that there would be some turmoil before the strong man comes to power. And that's exactly what we see. And amazingly, we made that prediction for many years, and now even the German media is totally puzzled and uncertain who will replace Chancellor Merkel. And if you look at the different Bible prophecies, which Mr. Fleury does in his article, the cover story of the Next Trumpet, we can only see one German leader that would come even close to be able to match those prophecies. Because there's a variety of prophecies that attest to that leader different qualities and different skills. And we believe there's only one man who matches those qualities.
So talk about some of those skills, some of those qualities that prophecy illuminates for us.
Yes. So prophecies show that this man will not only lead Germany, which is the strongest economy in Europe, but it says it will, he will lead, in, as a matter of fact, all of Europe, the 10 strongest nations. So that must be a leader that's well-connected throughout Europe. He must be a man of much experience, not only in Germany, but also in other countries of Europe. And he must be a man that people can look up to, and even other leaders will follow him. So he has extraordinary leadership skills, but also talks about that this man will come to power through flatteries, which means that he will have persuasive powers more than any other politicians and even inspire them to accept him as a leader without letting the people vote for him. That's some persuasive powers that we haven't seen any of those leaders, because none of them even have the support of the public, much less of their own party.
So why don't we go ahead and just talk about the cover of this next trumpet has Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg on it. And as far as the news sources that you're looking at, there's no one who is talking about him as being a potential candidate for chancellor. Is that right?
That's right. He comes up from time to time in discussions, but he himself says he has no interest and he has no political office in the moment, which means that he probably won't, people think he probably won't be able to enter the race at any time soon.
So, I would think if he's continuing to demur, he's saying that this isn't something that he's interested in, that's a good indication. Even though there would be a segment of the German populace who would be enthusiastic if he were to take power, he's obviously going to have to show that that's what he wants. In your view, you follow this man pretty closely. What sort of indications would you say there are that maybe he does have an interest, even if he's not expressing it?
Yes, so he always talks about that he keenly follows what happens in Germany. He's very interested in what's happening in Europe. He's concerned about the trends that he's seeing. He criticizes the leadership void. So he is a man of great passion for what's going on in Germany. And he says the little he can contribute to anything, he would like to do that, but he doesn't see himself re-entering politics. Because he had a very short, actually, political career in high offices of the economy ministry and the defense ministry. And that was a time that he said enjoyed, but he wouldn't like to go back. But other things show that he just recently moved back to Germany, and that was after his resignation as a politician in 2011, he moved to America. And that move indicates that he wants to get more involved in Germany in one way or another.
Well, is there anything that you would leave people with that you, having watched this so closely and looking ahead for what's going to be happening here over the next couple of weeks, that you'd want our listeners to pay attention to?
Yes, certainly. I know there's a lot going on in the world with the attempts to impeach President Donald Trump here in the U.S. and Brexit and the rise of China. But I really encourage our leaders to pay close attention to what's happening in Germany. We have watched that for years, but now might be the time where some dramatic will happen. And I really encourage our readers to read Mr. Fluey's article and see how this man that we are watching, Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg, is matching up with those Bible prophecies. And I encourage our readers to examine that article and then watch world events and see if that trumpet forecast is not coming true.
All right, well, thank you for that. We've been talking to trumpet writer Josue Michels about Germany's leadership crisis and who the next chancellor may be. We've just finished our January 2020 trumpet edition, and the cover story is by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. The title of that article is K.T. zu Guttenberg About to Come to Power. So as Josue just said, it has some pretty strong prophecies about what we can expect from Germany. And in some ways, he's talking about a conference from the ruling Social Democrat Party that'll be taking place over the weekend of December 6th through 8th. So we'll actually be able to watch that and see if anything interesting comes out of that. But we will put a link to that article by Gerald Fleury in the show notes for the program today. You can also check it out on thetrumpet.com's front page. Thank you very much, Josue. Very interesting stuff.
Thank you. Till next time.
It's time for today's last word.
Prayer is hard. Prayer that reaches God and produces results. But Jesus Christ was perfect at it. Throughout his life, he knew that to fulfill his colossal spiritual mission, he needed to maintain perfect contact with his Father. And he did that through daily, regular, continual communication. He prayed for long stretches in isolation, apart from others, when he wouldn't be disturbed. He also prayed as events were taking place that compelled him to reach out to his Father. He prayed for his disciples. And when he needed to seek God's guidance on a weighty decision like choosing his disciples or facing grievous trial, sometimes he spent multiple hours or even all night in prayer. You can read these examples all through the Gospels. Jesus prayed earnestly, fervently, with deep emotion, at times with strong crying and tears. His life depended on it. The Father's plan, humanity, depended on that. Before his crucifixion, Luke 22:44 says Jesus was in agony when he prayed. He wrestled in prayer and threw his whole being into it. And by doing so, he remained wholly unified in thought and purpose and spirit with his Father. And his prayer brought results. Christ's disciples saw his example, and they asked him to teach them to pray as he did. You can read that in Luke 11. And he gave them a prayer outline that focuses on praising the Father, on entreating for the Father to rule on earth, interceding unselfishly for God's work and for other people, repenting, praying for protection. Christ taught his disciples to avoid phony, showy prayer and vain repetition. He told them to build a sincere, intimate relationship with the Father. You can also read that in Matthew 6. So Jesus Christ is our teacher. He's our example. And it is his mind that Philippians 2:5 says we are to let be in us. And that includes our prayers. God wants you to pray like Christ. In fact, he wants you to pray with Christ's mind in the same spirit Christ prayed in. The Apostle Jude wrote, "But you, beloved, build yourselves up on your most holy faith. Pray in the Holy Spirit." Gerald Fleury wrote this in his booklet on Jude. Praying in the Spirit is not just prayer. It is life-changing prayer that gets through to God. It gets marvelous results. This is how we keep building that most holy faith. Can you discern if you're praying in the Spirit? This is a vital question that we need to answer. The Apostle Paul admonishes true Christians in Ephesians 6:18 to be praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints. So if Christ is inspiring your prayers, you're going to be focusing not on yourself, but on God the Father, on his family, on other people. You will offer persevering, persistent intercessions for others, just like Christ did. So when you're on your knees talking to God about someone or something, ask yourself how Christ himself would pray for that individual or how he would pray for that situation. Ask God to give you godly perspective and compassion and wisdom so that you can pray in more perfect harmony with his will. Throughout your prayers, strive to think like Christ. This will help you overcome selfishness, indifference, distractibility, drowsiness. It'll help you develop deeper humility, more love, more godly passion, moment by moment, work to fill your communication with the mind of Christ. And as you do, the most powerful result from prayer begins to unfold. Learning how to pray this way helps you grow in God's love. We have a book called How to Pray, and it says, intercession is hard, but what is happening as you learn how to pray this way? Meditating deeply on others' trials and troubles, bringing those before God, trying to beseech God passionately on their behalf in a way that's consistent with God's will, that changes your thinking. This book says, can you see how practicing that and learning how to do that is actually building the love of God? It is teaching you to think like God, to become God. God is deeply concerned for others. He's deeply concerned for his work. Hebrews 7:25 tells us that Jesus Christ ever lives to make intercessions. Well, you know, there's perhaps no more personal and profound way to learn to think like Christ than to work to emulate him as an intercessor. Build the daily habit of interceding for others by praying like Christ, and you will be developing the mind of Christ. That book says if you are driving yourself to give detailed, faithful, fervent, Spirit-led prayers on their behalf, those prayers are the love of God. The more perfect those prayers are, the more they reflect the perfect love of God. Herbert W. Armstrong taught that God's supreme creative accomplishment is to create his holy, righteous character in another being, to spiritually reproduce himself. Well, as we learn to pray like Christ, using the Spirit of God and building the mind of Christ, God is using that tool of prayer to reproduce himself in you. And prayer can achieve no greater, more awesome result than that. The more you bring Jesus Christ's mind into your prayers, the more God is accomplishing the most powerful result that can possibly come from those prayers, the creation of a God being. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guest, Joshua Michels. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from E.P. Powell. Thanksgiving Day is a jewel to set in the hearts of honest men. But be careful that you do not take the day and leave out the gratitude. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.